Aloha, it's Tuesday, January 13th. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. A Senate briefing on tourism turned heated yesterday. We'll listen in on the exchange and get reaction from a former Hawaii Tourism Authority board member. 2025 was one of Hawaii's deadliest years on the roads. We'll look into the reasons why and possible solutions. And why aren't more residents expunging their criminal record, even though they're eligible? We check in on a pilot program that was supposed to remove hurdles for the process on Hawaii Island. We look at the lack of paid parental leave for educators, how it affects us all. Plus, we mark the 50th anniversary of the Ko'olawe 9 protest. We revisit the historic landing and hear from Walter Riddy. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Sparks flew at a state Senate committee briefing yesterday. At issue was a $500,000 transfer between two Hawaii Tourism Authority programs. The once semi-autonomous agency is now an advisory committee living under the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, after allegations of mismanagement caused a shakeup in leadership last year. Senators Kurt Favela and Donovan De La Cruz appeared to grill DBET Director Jimmy Tokioka about his decision to shift $500,000 from a destination management program into a sports and signature events fund. Take a listen. You'll hear Favela first, then Tokioka and De La Cruz.
So for the new sports tourism committee, did you guys put any money in it already? Or this is just your ask?
This is, well, we put in $500,000 from a different fund that...
What fund is that?
A destination management.
Okay, so you had a conversation that we had in Kauai.
So who is we? Who is we?
We?
Yeah. He said, we put $5 million.
HTA and DBED.
No, who made that decision?
I did.
So not the board?
No. Well, but...
The
board was made aware of it, and the board was supportive of it. But now that it's advisory and not policy, we did talk to the chair and the vice chair of the...
Yeah, but the CEO reports to the governor, not the DBED director.
We don't have a... Well, we have a temporarily assigned...
Yeah, so do you have the statutory power to do that? I don't think so.
Well, we can check, but yeah.
I don't think so.
This morning, we spoke with Keith Vieira, the former hotel executive and original HTA board member, told us he supports Tokioka's decision. Vieira starts by making the case for the transfer of the funds.
When destination management was really at the forefront, is when people were concerned that we were well over 10 million visitors and how do we manage this going forward, which is a fair concern. You know, after that, we went through the pandemic and the Maui fires and now the overall downturn in business. So I do think it makes sense to put more money into areas that can expand our visitor base and hospitality spending. It's not a reflection to me on the job that's been done at destination management, whatever. I think that's a separate situation. But we definitely have to move money into marketing type areas. When you think about it, we basically spend $30 million and for about 15 years, we spent $100 million. And the cost of marketing has probably doubled or tripled during that time. So in essence, we're doing 10% of what we used to do for our number one industry in the state. So I think it is a good move. And sports and marketing does fit our brand image that matches to Hawaii. So I think this was a very good thing to do. But I think the fact that DBED is being proactive in understanding that with this potential situation of the loss of the golf tournaments, we have got to step up destination marketing, and through sports and activities is a great way to do it.
I know that when you were talking to Catherine Cruz in November, you talked about too much oversight for HTA. Is that something you think you saw bear out in yesterday's briefing? Do you still feel like there's too much oversight?
Yes, I do. I think the intent of what they want to do at HCA is good. I think getting that kind of discussion forum is good. But at the end of the day, we get $1.2 billion in TAT. They need to take 10% of that and contract it, I'm going to say directly with HVCB, whatever the entity is, but currently HVCB, and give them goals. If you look back over the last 35 years, there has never been a visitor spending or a number of visitor or anything like that goal. We need to have a goal on visitor spending. And so the entity that gets the marketing contract, I'm saying $100 million, needs to produce, you know, whatever it is, $28 billion in spending or whatever numbers that are there, and they need to be measured against it. And if they do it, they should continue it. Because the more they do it, the more we're going to get the TAT to be an even higher number. You know, it's probably one of the few investments that government makes that has a direct proven return. How come we're spending less when we should be spending more when we need more money?
You mentioned golfing there, and of course the Century was canceled for this year. But we've also heard in recent days that the PGA is shrinking its tour altogether and perhaps its footprint in Hawaii. So I gather you take that as a clear signal that more energy needs to be put into the space?
Yes, definitely. I mean, for many years prior to a lot of online marketing, the number one booking day for people coming to Hawaii was the day after the Hawaiian Open. You know, people are sitting there up and down the East Coast watching in the freezing snow, watching 4 days of sunshine and fun in Hawaii. And then we're going to Hawaii. So those type of programs that, you know, aren't out there saying, hey, come to Hawaii, but are reflecting the beauty of our destination, the uniqueness, et cetera, is going to be very influential for people. So I do think losing, if we were to lose both of these tournaments, there's that January, early January push during horrible weather times across the country that we're going to lose sitting in front of that great potential audience. So to me, it's a major concern.
I wonder if there's another way to think about it too, and maybe this is the harder question to confront, but PGA shrinking its tour, its footprint in Hawaii, is this a moment when we should be looking at things and saying, okay, the writing is on the wall. We need to sort of redirect how we think about Hawaii as a destination, rethink how we diversify the economy even?
Let me answer that last part first. People have been talking about diversification for 40 years. There is nothing else here. I mean, face it, we have the highest labor costs. We have the highest land costs, a one-party state, very, very strong unionization. I think number one union state in the country. Not to say that that's bad, but it does make it difficult for business. So why not look at what we do well, which is hospitality, and find ways to get more money from it? I think one of the best examples that I've seen is I recently was in San Miguel de Allende in central Mexico, and they took the waterworks plant, which a couple of acres in a large, huge building, and they turned it into an artisan's village. So you have artisans making tables, sewing outfits and making purses, et cetera, so that the kids in the community can go and learn what artisans do. But more importantly, as a visitor there, you can go and order your dinner table or whatever you're interested in. And here's a way of getting more money from visitors, supporting the community financially, and it's a win-win. When you look at how they view Hawaii relative to our product here, look when we do those pre-Christmas festivals where people are selling made in Hawaii goods. People go crazy for it, not just locals, but also all the visitors. Why isn't that year round? Why don't we have areas where we have artisans making things and then have them coordinate with the school so everybody can benefit by this? So I think that's out there. As far as the writing on the wall, the PGA situation is more with an issue of shrinking their schedule. And since Hawaii is the first stop because of our great weather, it's logical to them that maybe that shrinkage should come removing those tournaments. I don't think it's reflective on anything we do. The nice thing that was is that golfers are generally higher spenders, stay longer, enjoy all islands. So I think it's a really nice clientele. But when you think about it, why aren't we doing more marketing with beach volleyball, with surfing? We're the perfect place for Pacific tournaments for kids softball and baseball, etc. So we need to look at those type of activities getting that into the market. One of my pet peeves for years has been, if you go to the Indianapolis 500, there's a golf course around the outside. What if the Alawai Golf Course was around a major sports facility that had two 50-meter swimming pools, as you can't do that in Hawaii. There's only two places on the mainland, in Clovis and in South Seattle. What if we were the swimming headquarters for the Pacific? What if we were the headquarters for Pacific Little League Baseball? You know, those are the kind of things that bring families, and what people often forget to recognize with Hawaii, it's a repeat visitor destination. Nobody has a lot of wealth and just says, this year I'll go to Hawaii. No, what this is people who came after high school graduation with friends, came back for their honeymoon, came back for their 15-year reunion or whatever it is. It's that kind of destination. So if we can build more family first-timers, if we can build more interest in the healthful side of what we are with our great water and beaches and activities, that's going to help us overall in the long run.
And you mentioned there visitors who come and are higher spenders. And we've seen recent numbers indicating that headcounts for visitors are down, but spending is up. In your mind, is that the trajectory that we're looking for and looking to augment?
It's the narrative. I don't believe it's happening. I think how we're measuring it is different. I see many of the hotels and being down about 15 to 20%. We do know that the number of units available for alternative accommodation, short-term rentals, are up. But those are generally not high spenders. They're eating breakfast home. They go to Costco and get foods and et cetera. And we've all done that. Nothing wrong with that. But that high spending resort visitor count is definitely down. So I'm glad somebody's looking at something that keeps the focus on the higher spending. But, you know, not everybody coming here can be higher spending. You've got to start getting people come and building an affection for the destination. And you don't just, you know, and a wealthy person can sit down and choose the world. Good for them. But we need people who are like, oh, I need Hawaii. I need to go back and do my, every year I go for 2 weeks. That's the ideal customer.
Keith Riar, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Great. Thank you.
That was tourism consultant Keith Vieira. We spoke with him this morning about the visitor industry and the current state of the Hawaii Tourism Authority. Last year's upheaval led lawmakers and the governor to move the HTA under the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism.
The Biden administration's Infrastructure Act promised more than $1.5 trillion to build up the country.
For the first time in modern American history, we invest in all these different infrastructure sectors at the same time with one bill at the federal level.
It's been more than 5 years. Where did the money go? What was built? What never even got started? It's time to do some accounting. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Last year was a great year for grain harvest, but for farmers, high yields are not always the best thing for the old pocketbook.
Who's got the cheapest price? Well, it ain't us, sadly, and that's because of trade wars and tariffs.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What, pray tell, is vexing America's farmers? That's next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
. 2025 was Hawaii's deadliest year on the roads in nearly two decades, with 128 people killed statewide. Nationally, road deaths went down in the last year. So why is Hawaii bucking the trend? HPR contributor Yunji Denise recently spoke with Ed Sniffen, director of Hawaii's Department of Transportation, about what went wrong and what's being done to address the issue. Sniffen begins by breaking down the numbers.
When we start looking at the numbers, over 70%, nearly 90 people who died were our most vulnerable, our pedestrians, our bicyclists, and motorcycle riders. And you look at the numbers, over 90% of those fatal crashes were caused by bad behavior. either speeding, excessive speeding, drunk driving, or people not wearing their seatbelts or wearing their safety gear. All things that are absolutely preventable. 90% of the fatalities could have disappeared off of that docket if we had just done the right thing.
You've been sounding the alarm on this all throughout last year. You were trying to tell the public, if it's so preventable, how do you change that bad behavior?
I think the difficulty is we've already been trained to do it. The more we're allowed to speed without any repercussions, whether it be a ticket or a crash, the more we're going to do it. When we start talking to those that get their first DUIs, they admit that they've driven drunk about 85 times already prior to that first time. So for us, we want to make sure that we're forcing our system to slow people down and do the right thing. That's why you see so many speed humps coming into the system. That's why you see so many roundabouts being built in. And we're also going to make sure that we're increasing the amount of enforcement you see out there, not just by our speed cams and our red light cams. We're working with the sheriff now to put $2 million into their system to ensure that we can have more people out there. The county PDs are doing a really good job, but this just can't be everywhere. We want to make sure that we're putting more enforcement out there to ensure that we can ticket those that are not driving correctly, not because we hate them, but because we want them to get a ticket before they get into that crash.
Let's drill down in some of those measures that you talked about. We started out with those red light cameras. They've been on the roads for a while now, and you've added in now the speed cameras, moving from warnings to now full citations. Do those measures actually lead to changes in behavior?
Absolutely. Since the time that we put in the red light cams, we've seen a 60% reduction in red light running. Huge number of reductions ever since we started citing. We're seeing the same things now with the speed cams. We're not just ticketing people going for 1 mile over the speed limit. We want to make sure that we're targeting those that are really putting people in danger. And we're seeing reductions. As soon as we said we're going to start citing, we started seeing drop-offs in speeding by 20% or so in the systems that we already have. We want to make sure we can put these out into different areas now. By summer of this year, we'll put another 10 into the Honolulu district in areas where our data says is dangerous. And we start looking statewide to see where we could make improvements for safety.
What's also difficult when you drill down in those numbers, it's not just drivers. A lot of times it's pedestrians. What can be done on that end of the spectrum? I mean, we know we tell people look both ways and all of that, but how do we increase perhaps pedestrian awareness or making sure that we're just safer when we're crossing the street?
You absolutely hit it on the head. I think overall, when we start looking at traffic safety, I think in the past, the difficulty we had was we tried to separate the road from society. We saw drunk driving problems, or we saw speeding problems or distraction problems. We saw pedestrians not following the rules. Reality is, it's not a traffic safety issue. It's a societal one. When we start looking at drunk driving, we have a substance abuse problem in our society that flows onto our roadways. Same with distraction. We have a hyperconnectivity issue that's flowing through the roadways. And just like on speeding and jaywalking, we have people in our community that don't believe they need to follow the law that's flowing into our roadways. So really, overall, it's an accountability issue. We need to hold people accountable for their actions before the fatalities occur, which is why enforcement is going to be a big thing for us. We're putting in more safety bills this year to start really cracking down on enforcement, to make sure that we can get people to stop excessive speeding, stop driving drunk, and make sure that they're walking in areas where they should. I'm not going to put the blame on pedestrians, except when they're not following the law. The drivers still have to be aware because they're the ones that are driving the weapon. But pedestrians have to take their own safety into their own hands. The best thing that we can be on our system is consistent. When a driver knows they're going to see a pedestrian in a certain area, they'll react a certain way. When you see a pedestrian on H2 driving at 55 miles an hour or so, when you see a pedestrian, your brain doesn't register it's a pedestrian because you don't expect to see one there. So as a pedestrian in our family, we make sure that we make contact with the drivers before we start walking in front of them, because we want to make sure we take our own safety into our own hands.
You know, what strikes me about what you just laid out, when we think about those societal factors that then are impacting how we behave, whether we're a pedestrian or a driver, it's that we're all too busy, we're all too rushed, right? We're speeding because we're late for our appointment. We're texting because we want to tell the person, hey, I'm running late, or trying to get that last email out before we get to wherever we're going next. It sounds like it's really important for all of us to just build in a little more time.
Absolutely. Either build in the time in front or just understand it's okay to be late. When we start getting on the roadway, one thing that we like to talk about is making sure that you're mentally aware where you are when you get behind your wheel. When you get in your car, sit down, take some time to look at your phone and get your route set up. Understand how long it's going to take you to get there, so that while you're going along your route, you don't get all frustrated and try to call somebody mid-route. Understand the time frame you're going to take and understand the route you're going to take to get there. And second, collect yourself mentally. Understand where you are in your life. If you're pissed off because you just had a fight with somebody, maybe time to relax a bit before you get behind there. If you're overburdened because there's a big day ahead of you at work, understand that. Process it. I mean, we're not robots. We got to make sure we process that. But understand, though, I'm going to get behind the wheel and I got to be more aware of what's going on around me.
One of the things that also is a new variable on our roadways are these e-bikes and alternate vehicles. You know, you see these strange contraptions in traffic. You know, I see it downtown all the time, these one-wheeled folks that have just a helmet on and they're basically riding a unicycle in full traffic. We just had the holidays. We know that one of the most popular gifts for young people are the e-bikes. These are young people who are not trained in the rules of the road and are now interacting with traffic. Talk a little bit about, you know, do we adjust the roadway to now adapt to these new contraptions or what do we do?
Yeah, so yes and yes. Overall, infrastructure has to adjust to the new technologies that are coming through. But it's not going to happen in a short amount of time. In the interim, we got to make sure we put controls in place for everybody to ensure safety right now. And the first control is the parents. One of the things is, I don't believe many parents really understand the laws that govern e-bikes. They don't know it's a 750-watt cap. They don't know that you got to be 15 to drive it, to ride it. They don't know that an e-motorcycle is not road certified. So we want to make sure that the parents are understanding these things before they start purchasing for their kids. And second, we want to make sure that we clarify things. So for police, they can start enforcing. We love to see people using different modes of transportation to get around rather than just a car. But they got to do it safely. You'll see that those that are riding e-bikes, I don't think we as parents understand the power these things have now and the speed that it can go at. Those that are riding it don't always follow the law. You'll see them riding in lane with vehicles. And when at the red light, they'll transition to a pedestrian and go in the crosswalk, run across the intersection just to make sure they can go faster. We all got to take a breath here and make sure that we understand the rules of the road, understand what's required to ensure that we keep ourselves safe. And one of the big pushes we're trying to make is, in order to ride an e-bike, you should have your license. You should understand how the road operates before you can push something with that much power.
Okay, and we are almost out of time, but for people who are listening right now, what do you want them to think about or start doing the next time they get behind the wheel?
What I'd love to do is to have people to hold each other accountable. I'm sure if you ask the normal driver, they've sped a bunch of time on the roadway without a ticket, without a crash. In their mind, if somebody's driving slower than you, they're old. If they're driving faster than you, they're aggressive. So you're the best driver on the road. We all got to understand that we don't set the law. The law is set in place to ensure that everybody stays safe. Let's follow that. Let's stay within that zone so everybody's consistent in what they expect from you and everybody else around you.
Okay, we've been talking with DOT Director Ed Sniffen. Thank you for being here. Stay safe out there.
Thank you so much.
That was HPR contributor Yunji Denise speaking with Department of Transportation Director Ed Sniffen about last year's record number of fatalities. Here's to making 2026 much safer on our roads and driving with more aloha.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin February 2nd, olliuhm.org.
More people die from tuberculosis each year in India than anywhere else in the world.
1.5 million people die of TB every year globally. Of these, about 26-27%, you know, are in India alone.
Now, innovations in TB diagnosis are giving doctors their hope that patients will receive proper care sooner. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, celebrating its 10th anniversary with Josh Tatofi, performing songs such as Pua Kiele and Perfect to Me, this Friday and Saturday, BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Less than 1% of those eligible to have their criminal record expunged in Hawaii apply to do so. A new pilot program hopes to streamline the process and give those in Hawaii County a clean slate. Civil Beat reporter Madeline Valera has a story out today on this program, and she joins us now. Good morning, Madeline.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So why don't we start by giving listeners a reminder of what this pilot program is and what it was meant to do?
Yes. So this pilot program was a little bit limited in scope. It was just looking at people on the Big Island who had a record for a low-level drug possession charge. These were mostly, you know, less than an ounce of marijuana. And these were people who were charged with this but never convicted. So this pilot program went through those records and expunged them, meaning they're no longer available in a statewide criminal database. Record of that arrest is no longer stored with the Hawaii County Police Department. And those records were automatically expunged without those people having to apply for expungement.
Now, there are processes in place for people to have this done, but a lot of people haven't taken advantage of the system that's been put in place.
Yeah, that's right. People can apply. They can pay a $35 application fee and apply to go through this process. But fewer than 1,500 people per year actually, you know, take the initiative and go through this process. You know, it's complicated. Maybe people don't even know that they can do this. Some people might not even be aware that they have a criminal record to expunge. You know, people who were charged with something and never convicted, or their charge was dismissed, or they pleaded no contest. Those things can still show up on a criminal background check. So that's sort of the issue here, that legislators, you know, they really want to move more people through this process so that people can get their records cleared.
Do we have any sense of why so few people are taking advantage of the opportunity to expunge their record? I mean, it sounds like a lot of steps there to the process. Is that sort of the main hurdle, all of the parts of the process?
Yeah, I think it can be sometimes the fee. Sometimes it's that it's just intimidating to, you know, go back through the court system. People may need to get a lawyer. You know, maybe it's confusing. It's complicated. It's something that people just don't want to deal with. And also, like I mentioned, you know, people might not realize that their record could be showing up on a background check being conducted by an employer or a landlord. You know, if they were never convicted, it can still come up, you know, that you have a record, that you were arrested, that you were once charged with something. So it can still be affecting people.
Are there ideas out there from policymakers or people in the nonprofit sector to help make it easier out there, or even just information campaigns to help people, make people aware of the opportunity to expunge the record, or even possibly, as you're pointing out, the need to expunge the record?
Yeah, absolutely. There have been clinics, you know, every so often throughout the state, you know, clinics that help people for free to expunge their records. But what lawmakers are proposing now is having it be sort of like a state-initiated process. There's multiple other states in the country who have on the books that records must be automatically sealed, you know, certain qualifying records, like many states consider, you know, a misdemeanor. After a certain number of years, if you don't go on to be reconvicted of another crime, you can have that wiped, you know, automatically from the state system. So that's something that lawmakers are going to be looking into, not this legislative session, but next session.
Is there any reason not to have that sort of state-initiated? Is there an argument against that state-initiated process? Is there any sort of downside to being proactive, the state being proactive in expunging records that the state has deemed are expungible?
Yeah, well, the AG's office has said that it places a really big burden on their office. You know, by having a person apply, you get that fee, you know, which helps offset the cost of going through these records. It also provides the AG's office with important information, like the person's up-to-date address and contact information, so that they can then let that person know their records have been expunged. So taking away that whole process would put a lot of burden on the AG's office to, you know, find who's eligible and do all the work. It would be costly. But lawmakers argue that there would be a big benefit in the end. It would help more people get their records cleared, maybe get back to the workforce if that was something preventing them from getting a job. So, you know, there are a lot of benefits to this as well.
And just quickly, with a few minutes we have remaining, a few seconds we have remaining, is there a place folks could go to find out if they need to have their record expunged?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've ever been charged with something, you likely do have a record. You know, you have an arrest record that's living at the police department, as well as a record of that charge. So yeah, it's definitely something to look into. Okay. And on the AG's website, there's information about the process.
All right. Thank you for that, Madeline. Really appreciate the reporting. We've been hearing from Civil Beat reporter Madeline Valera. Read her story online at civilbeat.org. You might expect parental leave when you're expecting, but did you know that Hawaii educators are not guaranteed paid leave? A new national report highlights the lack of paid parental leave for teachers across the country and urges states like Hawaii to follow the examples set by others. We spoke with Heather Pesky about the costs and negative consequences caused by the lack of paid parental leave. Pesky is the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality, which put out the new report. Pesky begins by summarizing the findings.
We found that two-thirds of states offer no guaranteed paid parental leave for teachers beyond the sick days that they accumulate. So right now, we're really lacking strong paid parental leave policy for teachers across the country.
I want to dial down on some of this state-by-state stuff, but before that, a little bit more big picture. How does the U.S. stack up against other countries in terms of this sort of dire picture you've painted? How does that compare to other countries?
I mean, generally speaking, the U.S. is not as good at providing paid parental leave as other countries, particularly our counterparts in the European Union. But more specifically, in terms of how paid parental leave policy stacks up in the U.S. for teachers, one of the things that we found is that when we look at paid parental leave for teachers in the U.S. compared to other industries in the U.S., only one in three teachers report access to paid parental leave. And this is 14 points lower than other employees in other professions.
Only 16 states require districts to offer paid parental leave. Hawaii is not among them. Talk about that bigger bucket that Hawaii's in.
Sure. Well, first I will say the U.S. is the only high-income country without guaranteed paid leave for new parents. And this leaves many teachers, nearly 80% of whom are women, without the support they need to care for their growing families. Now, more specifically, when it comes to Hawaii, Hawaii is one of the states that does not offer paid parental leave to teachers. And so this means that teachers in Hawaii have to hoard their sick days. They have to do things like try to have their children in the summer when they're off. It's just kind of ridiculous what we're asking teachers in Hawaii to do in order to ensure that they have their own families that they can support.
Yeah, this is remarkable, the fact that teachers rely, by and large, definitely in Hawaii and in many other states, on simply acquiring accumulated sick days to have their children. And clearly, trying to make a schedule where you can have a kid during 2 months of the year or accumulating sick days, those are bad things. That sounds like a dysfunctional system. But beyond that, what are some of the side effects that the lack of paid parental leave has on the education profession?
Well, one of the things that we know is that the benefits of paid parental leave include lower infant mortality, better developmental outcomes for kids whose parents took leave, better physical and mental health outcomes for new mothers. We also know that paid leave stabilizes the workforce. So paid family leave significantly boosts the likelihood that workers will return to their jobs. And when it comes to teachers, we're essentially asking teachers to choose between having their own children and having their own children and supporting them as teachers and supporting their students. So we're asking teachers to choose between their own families and their jobs. And when we do that, we all lose, because oftentimes teachers will choose their own families naturally, and it means that they leave the classroom. And when teachers leave the classroom, it's destabilizing for students, and it's also really costly for districts. We have research estimates that large districts spend roughly $25,000 to replace a single teacher when they leave the classroom. So this is very costly not to provide paid parental leave to teachers.
Yeah, that number really stood out to me, that $25,000 for larger districts to replace a teacher. We'd like to always rely on altruism and humanity, but the bottom line, follow the money, is always part of the story. And it's important to keep an eye on that cost that develops because of these dysfunctional policies. And yeah, 15% leaving the profession. 15% of teachers cited that they were leaving the profession because of the issue of family and parenting. Are there states that are setting an example on this front, a state that has a program or an approach that might be a good model for others to follow?
Yes, we featured two states in our report, Delaware and Arkansas. These are the only two states we found that are exemplary, and they're really important to consider. Delaware and Arkansas are exemplary because they each provide 12 weeks of paid leave. And they cover the full cost of long-term substitutes while the teachers are out on leave with their own children. So these are two very different states, and they both offer really interesting examples of places where policymakers came together to ensure that they're providing both the paid leave to teachers and also the financial support to districts to be able to afford to pay for the long-term substitute costs.
And beyond that 12 weeks that's recommended, are there other components to a good plan that you see? I think you mentioned guaranteed teachers receive full salary while on leave, but also the issue of extending eligibility to define parenthood in a pretty expansive way.
That's right. We're making three recommendations in this report. First, that states should provide and fully fund 12 weeks of fully paid parental leave for teachers. Second, lawmakers should guarantee that teachers receive their full salary for the entire duration of the leave so that they can afford to stay on the paid parental leave. And third, in terms of eligibility, policymakers should ensure that they're extending the parental leave benefits to include all teachers who welcome a child into their family. And this includes fathers, it includes adoptive parents, and it also includes other parents who didn't give birth to the child, but who are the parents of that child. So these are the three main recommendations of our report.
And they all seem like very good, very sensible recommendations until perhaps we talk about money. That's always the more thorny conversation to have. Talk about funding models. I know so many districts already put such a high percentage of their budget toward teacher salaries, and still so many teachers are underpaid in general terms. So how do these ideal programs get paid for?
Well, certainly we need to consider cost when we're talking about paid parental leave. And we also need to consider the cost of not providing paid parental leave to teachers. But when it comes to the cost, states fund paid parental leave in several ways. Sometimes they leave the cost to districts. Sometimes the states reimburse districts for substitutes or for teacher salaries. And sometimes we found that states are creating statewide programs to reimburse teachers directly. And here I would say that if you want to kind of look and estimate how much it would cost, we developed something we call the paid parental leave calculator. And this is to make it more easy for states and districts to do the math to see how much it would cost per taxpayer to pay for paid parental leave for teachers. And in some places, it's quite affordable, especially, as I said, in contrast to not offering paid parental leave and risking seeing your teachers leave the profession.
Something that we already see a lot of here in Hawaii, a big issue with retention, with cost of living and so forth. This is just another factor added on for those who are working in education. You highlighted two states with good programs, Arkansas and Delaware. I think the Arkansas one is a good one to dial down on just a little bit more, especially with regard to this question of funding, because their plan was put in place relatively recently. In 2023, they passed a law that initiated paid parental leave for educators, but then revisited it again to do some revisions. Could you talk a little bit about those? Because I think those details are really important.
Yes, we spotlighted Arkansas as one of the two states. And as you said, there was a law passed in Arkansas that recommended that districts give teachers paid parental leave. And what happened there is that not all districts offered paid parental leave to teachers. And so they went back and revised this law. And now this is a requirement that districts are offering paid parental leave to teachers, 12 weeks of paid parental leave. So that's one of the reasons that we spotlighted it, is that the first time around, they didn't see the results they wanted. And when they went back and revised the law, they did so in order to ensure that teachers were getting access to paid parental leave. And the way that they did this is also pretty interesting in terms of the specific details. When they first implemented this in 2023, they used this optional cost-sharing model, but very few districts took them up on this optional cost-sharing model. So in 2025, they passed Act 904, which transformed the benefit into this fully funded state program covering the costs of substitutes so that the districts would continue to pay the teacher salaries and the state would kick in the funding to pay for the long-term substitute costs. And legislators really have talked about this as an opportunity to take something that worked in 2023 and make it even better. So they built on this good idea in order to ensure that even more teachers would get access to paid parental leave.
I thought that was such a great example, because so often when you see a piece of legislation not work once it's implemented, politicians have a habit of running from that legislation and disowning it. And here you saw them going back to the table and figuring out how to make it work.
That's right. Arkansas went back to the table in 2025, and their legislators worked together to figure out how they could support districts to offer the funding for long-term substitutes so that districts could in turn offer fully paid parental leave for 12 weeks to the teachers in their districts. So it's a really nice example of strong bipartisan work and collaboration across the state.
And I know you work in the realm of education and not politics, but I just have to acknowledge and get your reaction. You sort of alluded to it there, but it really seems like this is something that this could be a policy area that could supersede entrenched political positions.
Certainly. Part of the reason that we did this report is that the evidence is so strong that paid parental leave is really good for new parents and certainly good for new children. And, you know, part of the reason we did this work is that paid parental leave is such an important policy in terms of the outcomes for parents, in terms of the outcomes for children, and in terms of the outcomes for students. And so given paid parental leave's importance in terms of positive outcomes for our communities, we're really urging lawmakers to work together to pass paid parental leave policies that are accessible to all teachers for 12 weeks. When we consider this as a policy, paid parental leave is popular across the political spectrum because it makes good sense in terms of the benefits for families, for children, and certainly for teachers. So I would urge us to really think about across the country, and certainly in Hawaii, how can we invest in paid parental leave for teachers? Because if we do so, we'll really strengthen families, support teacher retention, and ultimately lead to better outcomes for children.
That was Heather Pesky, president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. The report discussed was just released to the public, and we'll have a link to it on our website later today.
Now, things seem to be working out in Trump's favor. Venezuelan interim government has already announced that it's going to embark on a massive legal reform, potentially changing the oil laws to give foreign companies a greater say in how it's run.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, with works from around the globe spanning 5,000 years, offering fresh discoveries and new perspectives. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Thank you.
50 years ago, 9 activists arrived on Ko'olawe to protest military actions on the island. HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel recently had the chance to reflect on the protests with some of the organizers, and she's here to tell us about it. Morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So maybe quickly just remind our listeners of this really important history.
Yeah, absolutely. So for decades, Ko'olawe was bombed as a practice area by the U.S. military. And of course, that caused a lot of concern, a lot of history, a lot of sacred sites on the island. And Walter Riddy was one of those who, as you mentioned, was among the Ko'olawe 9. He was a hunter on Molokai who was raising awareness on the island about access issues at that time. And he says, you know, then no one really was educated or talked about Hawaiian rights or history, you know, and in raising awareness of these issues, they were sort of going against the grain on Molokai. And at that time, a group on Maui was actually putting together a mission to go to Ko'olawe, and they asked him to join them. And there was quite a large group that was going, but, you know, in talking story with Uncle Walter and Auntie Loretta Riddy on Molokai, sharing their memories, he says that helicopters came to threaten that group, and most of them turned back to Maui. But one small group succeeded, and they made it to Ko'olawe for that first landing on January 4th, 1976.
9 of us jumped on the boat, went to Ko'olawe, and 7 of them started opening the canned goods and started eating and stuff. Emmett and I went Mauka. We wanted to see what the island looked like. It looked just like West Molokai. So we felt at home. We got all the way to the top of the island. We saw them taking everybody off the island. So we stayed till dark, and then we went down. And then in the morning, we decided, well, we'll just go take a look while we're here. So we went and started going spent another day or so just walking around and looking to see. So the third day we were ready to get off the island, and as we went into the helicopter, I was sitting there in the helicopter ready to go up, and I was melancholy and like hungry and tired and everything, and I was staring at this rock, and the helicopter went up into the air, and I was glued to this one rock, and the rock turned into the whole island. And then I had this funny feeling starting in my toes, was tingling my toes, and came up and took over my body. And I heard in my brain that I am going to die. And the thing just kept playing over and over, I am going to die. And I kind of lost it.
Wow, what an experience. How did he interpret that moment?
Yeah, so he took it as a message from the island, you know, not that Walter was going to die, but, you know, that it was a call for action so that this island wouldn't be lost, you know, due to the bombing. And he said that that was really a life-changing moment for him in recognizing, you know, the need for to really stop what was happening on the island. And, you know, at this time, he was in his early 30s. You know, his wife and kids were on Molokai. You know, this is a pretty risky mission that they all took on. And I asked Auntie Loretta if she ever, you know, worried for his safety. Here's what she told me.
I believe there was a greater source guiding them. The kupuna, whether they were here in Pule or prayer for them, or the kupuna have gone before us. But I always felt that they had a protection, and that whatever they were going to do would be okay because of that. And so I felt really comfortable knowing who Walter was as a hunter and a survivor. So I was okay with the whole situation, knowing that kupuna were guiding and protecting them, and that he knew how to take care of himself and situations around him.
And she told you about a decision of her own that she made, yes?
Yeah, so just 2 weeks after he initially landed on the island with that group, she actually joined him along with his sister Scarlett from Molokai. And, you know, Auntie Loretta talked about, you know, how he was really different when he came back from the island, and she wanted to experience that too. And, you know, she talked about her own reflections being there. But, you know, all of this effort that they were involved in, along with a couple others from Molokai and this group of nine, you know, they really became part of the Hawaiian Renaissance, in which, you know, there was a resurgence of interest in education and practice of hula, language, culture, and all of this kind of came together and you know, really became a part of, you know, our history. They recently held an event on Oahu, you know, to commemorate the 50th anniversary, but also talk about the current issues that are, you know, that we're addressing today and that Walter wanted to raise awareness of. So here he explains.
50 years later, the military now wants to continue all of their land leases in Hawaii. And it's becoming a big issue. So we decided, let's go celebrate Kaha'olawe, but let's also talk about the issues in the Hawaiian community. So we organized Kaha'olawe speakers. We organized speakers to talk about Mauna Kea, because Mauna Kea is coming back on the table. They want to put Mauna Kea not in the place that they wanted to do it at first. They're going to move it to a different site on the same mountain. So that's going to be another big issue. And then they started attacking Kamehameha schools. So we had Kaha'olawe, Mauna Kea, Kamehameha School, and we had a room full of interesting people with all these different issues. Like, yes, we have success here, but it's not over. That these are major issues that in the Hawaiian community that we're going to need to address. And the next generation is going to have to step up. Us guys getting tired, not tired, but slower. And we know Akamai, all these new instruments to communicate with each other. But the next generation is going to have to want to continue the work to make sure that, at least Hawaiians, that we have a kuleana. And that kuleana is to make sure that our future generations have the same opportunities on these islands as we had.
Just briefly, Catherine, before we leave, do they talk about opportunities they have to engage younger generations on what they've done?
You know, I think they talked a lot about music being, 50 years ago being kind of a catalyst for gathering people together. This event that they held recently involved a lot of music and, you know, just engaging, educating, sharing, you know, the history again.
Yeah.
And inspiring the next generation to kind of pick up that role.
Well, it sounds like it was a fantastic talk story session. And we're glad you shared it with us. Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks so much, EW.
We've been talking with HPR Maui Nui reporter Catherine Kluet-Pachtel. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And a programming note, on Friday, we'll have a Hanaho show that features more voices from the Protect Ko'olawe Ohana. Stay tuned. That wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan a live call-in show to discuss immigration enforcement in the islands. What do you think about the presence of ICE agents in Hawaii? Call in live or leave us a voicemail at our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can also email us your thoughts at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm D.W. Gibson. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.